You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. My name is Doug Paul. I'm Vice President for Studies here at the Endowment. We have an Asia program, some China specialty. But today we've gathered to talk about a very hot topic, China's economy in the post-crisis world is the formal title, but it could be China's economy in the emerging American Chinese political crisis world, if you were to read all the headlines or this morning's New York Times editorial precisely on the subject of China's exchange rate. So we're gathered at a good time. The president has spoken recently to the Democratic senators about his determination to be firm with the Chinese currency. The premier of China just closed out the National People's Congress in Beijing, saying China was going to keep the currency basically stable. And the clock is ticking on a soft but nonetheless pretty real April 15 deadline for the Treasury Department to report to Congress on misaligned currencies, and everybody's focusing on the Chinese currency. Senator Schumer and Lindsey Graham yesterday submitted a new version of their fairly draconian bill for how to remedy problems with China on currency. So today I'd like to draw on the talents of our very distinguished panel to talk about the broad setting in which this political discussion is taking place both here and in China and elsewhere. First to speak this morning will be Tom Byrne, who's from Moody's, based in Singapore. He's come all the way from Singapore to take part in this event, and we're very grateful for that. He is a very experienced hand in judging sovereign risk and the Asia-Pacific economies in general, and can give us, I think, a first good look at the situation with China. Then we'll follow that up with Bert Keidel, who is now with the Atlantic Council, who has been very active in both Treasury Department here at Carnegie Endowment and elsewhere on the Chinese economy for many years. And I think he'll give a very strong perspective on the recent outcomes of the National People's Congress and current situation in China. And then finally, our non-resident associate, Peter Botelier, who's, again, another person with very rich experience in World Bank and elsewhere, currently teaching at Johns Hopkins SAIS as well, to talk about his views on where China sits. I'm not going to take much more time because I know you're here to hear about the economics and what's going on between the U.S. and China. And I'll first turn to Tom Byrne for his remarks. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Doug, and thanks to Peter for inviting me. It's a pleasure to get out of the tropical climate of Singapore, actually, into this nice weather. But also, I'll give you my views, say, from a credit market view on China, and then I look forward to the views of my fellow panelists, for sure. Let's see if I can do this right. Okay, good. First of all, just some perspective. Moody's history with rating Chinese PRC government bonds starts in 1988. I should say, as a footnote of interest for those who are interested in history, Moody's is more than 100 years old, so we actually rated Qing Dynasty bonds. So these were railway bonds that were fostered upon China by the colonial powers. A lot of them defaulted. But we, back in 1988, our initial rating assignment for China was A3. Similar to the other East Asian countries at the time, that was a very forward-looking rating back then because we only downgraded China once right after Tiananmen. For political and economic reasons. It was a time of economic turmoil. But what we have now is something metaphorically or allegorically similar to what the European Union, the Maastricht Treaty, has put together. We have a growth and stability rating story for China. I think the longer China demonstrates growth with stability, probably the higher the ratings will go up. Right now we have an A1 rating, which is a high rating, with a positive outlook. And you can see since we took our first positive action from the A3 base, China's growth rate has remained relatively high and its inflation rate relatively low. Before things had settled down to some sort of coherence in the global economic system and financial system, we took a positive rating action on China, thinking that China, observing that China had already navigated through the worst of the global financial crisis, and we anticipated that it would be able to manage well over the next, certainly, 2 to 3 years. There are greater uncertainties the longer you look out. But that last point there, we think China's pragmatic and cautious policies have reduced systemic risk. Now, what we find in terms of exacerbating sovereign credit risk is usually three channels by which this can happen. One for the, lesser developed emerging market economies tends to be through the balance of payments, some sort of shock to the balance of payments. And with China, there's actually extremely low, more so than very low, but extremely low vulnerability to the external credit market and to financial shocks. Of course, everyone knows that China has more than $2 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. This provides a very good buffer. Those reserves, the way things are going, could reach $3 trillion by the end of next year. But also, those reserves are really formidable. But China also has, the banks have a net foreign asset position. We all know that China is now the world's leading exporter. And it still receives a very hefty amount of foreign direct investment, although it's not a large share of GDP as it once was some years ago. But all these things suggest that we don't expect any current economic currency shocks to affect China. Also, I should say that when you look at government exposure to foreign currency debt or to external markets, it's extremely low. China is actually similar to Korea, Thailand, and some other countries where government debt denominated in foreign currency is less than 5%, I think much less than 5% in the case of China. So there's very little vulnerability to sudden shifts in creditor confidence or disturbances in the international credit market. Another channel through which sovereigns get into trouble is through their banking systems. Through the banking systems. And China has, we think that the contingent financial sector liabilities are very small. I'll talk about it a little later. I just have a short five-slide presentation. Also, China has very high household and corporate savings, which also means that China doesn't have to go offshore to borrow. And unlike, say, the crises, recent crises in Iceland, in the Baltics, Hungary, not so much Greece, where the channel of transmission came through a sudden stop in credit, external credit, through the banking system. So China doesn't face that problem. And then lastly, the third one is through a government debt problem. China has very low government debt. It has ample fiscal headroom to absorb domestic shocks that could come from, say, a sharp increase in bank NPLs, which we think is unlikely, or through some sort of limited implosion in local government finances. I'll talk a little about that. So China has low debt. The debt-to-GDP ratio is only about 16 or 17%. In the U.S. now it's 80%. But the U.S. is an advanced country. The markets are different. So it has but in most emerging market countries we're talking about that are comparable to China, the debt levels are, say, in between, 40, 50% of GDP, sometimes a little bit higher for countries rated in the A range. And so we don't see much of a risk on that side. Plus, we think the debt is affordable. In other words, the Chinese government can finance its deficits with reasonable interest rates. Now, the Greek fiscal crisis that is unfolding is a fiscal crisis. So countries still get in trouble for borrowing too much and having uncontrolled expenditure. So on those three fronts, plus the overall policy stance and policy capabilities, we decided to put a positive outlook on China's rating. Now, if we were to upgrade China's rating, it would go to the AA range. The AA range is the range right below the gold standard, the AAA range. And again, we highlight that robust government finances and macroeconomic stability, the maintenance of such would prompt us to raise China's credit rating. This slide goes to show you that just like U.S. Treasuries and also I think JGBs, there was a flight to quality after the during the financial crisis, and you'd see that the yields had tightened. Right now, the 10-year bond yield in China has a yield of about 3.5%. That's actually right about where the U.S. Treasury 10-year yield is, a little wider than, say, German bonds, about the same as Korean 10-year Treasury bonds as well. So China's doing fairly well on that front. It can afford to finance its deficits. This year, 2010, perhaps China's deficit will be a little larger than last year, but it's still relatively manageable at maybe 3.5% of GDP and affordable, too, at these interest rates. In other words, interest rates this low won't squeeze out put pressure on other types of spending, particularly social welfare spending, which is important in China. Peter asked me to focus a little on the financial sector. I'm a sovereign analyst, but I do get involved in the rating committees for Chinese banks since the government owns the biggest banks. I guess if I were the analyst for the U.S., I'd be involved in rating U.S. banks since the citizens of the U.S. own a lot of U.S. banks as well. We also have a positive outlook on a number of Chinese banks on the bank financial strength rating, the intrinsic strength. But we have something divorced from the, not completely divorced, but separate from the individual bank outlook. We have industry outlooks. And 2 months ago now in January, we put China's industry outlook back to stable from negative. We did this with 11 other Asian systems and most systems globally as well now. However, four in Asia remain negative. Japan is the biggest one. Vietnam is another one, and there's two others. Entering 2009, the banks in China had high capital levels, low NPLs, and were well provisioned. In fact, through 2009, and if you compare the beginning of 2009 at the end of 2009, the banking system NPLs had actually shrunk. Now, you could argue part of that is because the NPLs were diluted by the huge expansion of loans. Well, that's true to some extent in a ratio sense because now the NPLs are 1.6%. I think they were a little above 2%. I'm talking about from the end of 2009 versus the beginning of 2009. But they also decreased in absolute terms as well, just the renminbi value of NPLs. So the banks are what they've learned over recent years is risk management. That was absent 10 years ago, that's for sure. So that's a good sign. Also, the banks are well capitalized. They probably will have to raise more capital to meet internal regulatory standards that the China Bank Regulatory Commission sets. Now, these standards are more stringent than the international standards that the BIS BAL ratios suggest. At any rate, we think that – don't want to get too far ahead of myself. Let me just see what this is. We think that the Chinese banks, Tier 1, the big Chinese banks will remain and not have – remain. Their Tier 1 ratios will remain at 9% with additional some additional capital raising this year. And the total BIS ratios will be 12%, which is a very healthy ratio considering the NPLs levels. Also, our central scenario is that NPLs do inch up, but only to about 2% over the next year or two. Beyond that, however, they could rise more if the authorities don't control lending. Our assumption is that bank loans grow about 20% this year versus a little more than 30% last year. Let me see. And then, of course, the three biggest banks in the system, ICBC, CCB, and BOC, their intrinsic bank financial strength ratings are under review for possible upgrade. With the financial strength rating, what we're looking at is the capital adequacy of the bank's ability to control risk, the franchise value, the profitability of the banks as well, and the disclosure, the financial disclosure of the banks. Now, the Chinese banks have fairly low BFSR in the D-minus range. That would likely go up. The global average is C. This is on a scale of A, which is the best, down to E, which is the weakest. E means imminent or actual government intervention to support the bank. When we do a very severe stress test, that would probably macroeconomically imply that growth stays below, well below 8% for a number of years. We come out, we don't see a collapse of the banking system. In fact, although NPLs would deteriorate, they would increase several fold over the our baseline scenario, which would, if the very severe stress case were to be realized, the banks would need to basically recapitalize themselves. But it wouldn't. This wouldn't be an overnight occurrence. Even in a worst case, we think it would take several years to unfold. And it's just a. It's the risk. It's the tail risk that we have for China's system. Our base scenario is that China's banks and the Chinese government will handle the challenges of coping with the loan surge last year and ensuring that banks' asset quality remains good. Well, what could go wrong over our outlook horizon? Being in from a credit rating agency, sometimes we're uncomfortable being so positive. It's much more comfortable to be skeptical and negative, it seems, at times. But on China, we are positive on the sovereign outlook, sovereign credit outlook, as well as the banking sector outlook. Well, what could go wrong? What we're primarily worried about, mainly because of the murkiness of the information, is all this lending that's gone on to the local governments. Now, some of it has occurred in this new bond market that has taken off, the so-called Chengtou bonds, which are these local construction and investment corporations on the city level. It's not all that big, but it's a concern, as well as bank lending to financing vehicles set up by local governments. And we don't have a good grasp on this. There's a lot of estimates out there, but the government hasn't come up with a definitive estimate. The estimates range from, I think, $4 trillion to $11 trillion renminbi, as against, say, by the end of this year, GDP will be about $40 trillion renminbi. So it could be substantial. However, we think loans made to provincial level and big city levels, particularly those are on the eastern part of China, are probably very good. Even if the projects don't have a revenue stream, those governments at the provincial level or municipal level are strong enough to repay the loans. It's loans made to below banks, loans made at the county level or, say, to smaller cities would cause us more concern, but I don't think they're all that big. Of course, we don't have all the information on this. And also, we think that loans made by not only the big state-owned banks but also the joint stock banks are probably fairly good because risk management has improved over the years. However, loans made by the city commercial banks and the rural commercial banks probably are a bit riskier loans. But again, they're a smaller share of the total amount of loans provided by the banking system in China. So the public sector finances are a bit of a concern. Now, we think that the government will probably come in and provide some degree of support, but it wouldn't provide carte blanche support to the whole system. I think the moral hazard would be much too great. There's an example where the government has allowed even a province to fall into bankruptcy. That was back in 1998 under the Gidic bankruptcy. That was in part motivated by financial mismanagement by that entity, and I think the Chinese government wanted to send a lesson. So the same, something similar could play out again in the future where the government is selective in providing support to distressed banks or to distressed corporations, distressed government entities, local government entities. So that's our immediate concern, and we highlighted that when we actually put a positive outlook on China's sovereign credit rating back in November 9th in the press release. Our other concerns are ability to maintain low inflationary expectations. I think that's true in every sovereign rating, just about. We're also concerned about what impact the trade frictions with the U.S., as Doug mentioned today, and also with the EU, how that could play on export growth. But then on the other hand, as Peter said to me or to everybody, to me this morning. I've only been off the plane for about 3 days. We were talking this earlier before the meetings. We think that China, without any net contribution from exports, China's economy can grow at least, I would say, around 8%, just based on domestic demand. Now, Peter pointed out to me this morning, one-on-one, not to everybody, in front of everyone, that last year domestic demand grew by 12% in China?
12.3%.
Okay, 12.3%. Now, that was exceptional, but under normal conditions where banks are lending at more or less normal rates, historically, say over the past 5 to 5 years or longer, China has grown at 8%. So that 8% seems to be the bottom line and a realistic growth trajectory for China. And with something like that, we think that the banking system can, with growth at that level or at that rate, we think the banking system can deal with the future challenges that will arise over the next 2 to 3 years, maybe a little longer, as the effects of this credit surge materialize on the banks loan portfolios and affect the asset quality of these loans. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a little shuffle of seats here as Bert moves over to get near the computer. We've had the benefit of hearing a very upbeat review of what the Chinese financial system looks like. I'm kind of regret we didn't ask Tom to do a comparative analysis of the U.S. versus China. That might have been instructional for a lot of people in Washington who tend to think that we're always fine, we're always doing great, don't worry about anything. But the picture of China is one that's quite encouraging. And I imagine as someone looks at Asia broadly, I think the region as a whole is going to take a lot of satisfaction from seeing China being such a source of stability as they try to resume levels of growth, and as they already have resumed levels of growth on the back of China's stimulus performance in the past year. Now, Bert Keitel, please.
Thank you, Doug. And Peter, thank you for the invitation. And I'm also grateful to Uri Dadush in the International Economics Program here at Carnegie. I'm going to talk about some of the repercussions of what we've learned about the Chinese economy and also comments by Chinese leaders at the National People's Congress and the U.S. reaction. I think there is a kind of a blend here of theater, which plays to the politics in both capitals, and also what it concerns me increasingly as possible threats to U.S. national interests and U.S. national security interests, as the United States seems to react ever more strongly to China in ways that ignore the legitimate success that China's having in its economic performance, and in turn say that it's based on some kind of cheating or that it relies on the U.S. growth in a kind of a predatory way. And I think this is troubling. I mean, I go back generations of public servants in America, and my undergraduate motto was in the nation's service. It's troubling that, in the first place, we might look at things in this way rather than looking more at ourselves and the need for reform in a broad range of dimensions that are brought on America by globalization. But also that it could build resentment, unjustified resentment in the United States towards China. And I think that would make collaboration in the future much more difficult and even prepare us for a relationship of some confrontation. So I'm quite concerned from the perspective of the interests of the United States how this is going. Now, in the National People's Congress, we saw reports by the various commissions and ministries, and the basic message from those reports was sort of steady as it goes. The economy has recovered. There's a lot of confidence, but we're not out of the woods yet. I see the World Bank in this morning's papers has just said that they're going to recommend that China cool off the economy more than has been said before. I think that's a little premature. And I'm going to show you why I think that's the case. But perhaps the most interesting dimension of the National People's Congress was Wang Jiabao, the premier's press conference at the end, in which he became quite a combative towards the United States in particular on issues like the U.S. debt, the exchange rate, what he called U.S. protectionism. So I think when we look at the overall economic situation in China at this point, I want to keep those in mind, and I'll bring them up as we go ahead. Now, this is just an overview of the GDP growth record. Can I use your pointer? You have a laser in that, Peter? Yeah. And as you can see, the current downturn, or slowdown, really, the yellow box here, I guess I do this, yeah, this shows the growth slump associated with the global crisis. This shows, This shows the price drop in the GDP deflator. So we're seeing low prices last year, prices falling on average. The growth peak before this wasn't as high as previous growth peaks, nor has this decline been as low as previous declines. So Chinese is successfully moderated. Part that's because the crisis hit at the end of one year and at the beginning of another. So, in fact, they have done more poorly than this shows. I would point out, though, that this record of fluctuations is almost negatively correlated with GDP growth in the United States, which is one of the indicators that China's growth has not been export-led. And I stress that because the common idea that China is just like Japan and South Korea, the economy of Taiwan and so forth, is that, well, it's just like all these other Asian economies. It's been export-led. It depends on the United States. The statistical record shows that that's not the case, and I encourage you to take a look at an earlier Carnegie publication that makes that point fairly clearly by looking at every twist and turn in the Chinese macro experience. If we look at this on a quarterly basis, this is the official GDP growth rate on a quarterly basis year over year. Now, that has a smoothing effect, so it all kind of drops down to 6.2%, and then last quarter it came back to 10.7. The smoothing is deceptive. The downturn here was clearly much more serious, and there's no really accepted or clear, foolproof way to measure how deep that is. It's an art form right now, which is called seasonally adjusted GDP growth. And here is my estimate. I've been doing this for, at least if you go back to manufacturing data, since the late 1980s, GDP data. I worked with the Statistical Bureau when I was working with the World Bank in Beijing to try to, this was 12 years ago, and they still haven't produced their own seasonally adjusted. They're going to. But as you can see, it dropped rather dramatically, and as you'll see in a minute, other estimates don't show it quite as extreme, and then it recovered dramatically. And then I have it coming back down to only an annualized 6.5% growth rate. So this official growth rate covers or averages through or smooths what has been a really dramatic drop in at the time that the crisis struck, and then a sharp recovery as China used its stimulus program to good effect. And then it has sort of reined that in to some degree. Now, if we look at the there are a range of other estimates. The Wall Street Journal has put out about 12. I've looked at them. Half of them don't quite work because you don't – ideally, this, when you work it out, should give you exactly this. And about half of those in the Wall Street Journal survey don't. They're too high, too low. They jump all over the place when you try to make them consistent. But half do. The central bank, the People's Bank of China, the PBOC, has put out its own estimate of this. And if you can compare it with mine, you see that it starts a little higher, doesn't go as low, doesn't go as high, stops at about 11%, a little under 11%. So I don't think this difference is that significant. And we'll see in the point that I want to make, it doesn't really matter. Nevertheless, you see the impact of the crisis right here with both of us. Now, I'm interested in what happens going forward into this period here. And let's just assume, and I'm glad that Tom mentioned 8% as a potential growth rate. Let's just assume that both of these quarter-on-quarter growth rates level off at 8%. The Chinese, that's their target, but they really hope it doesn't go that low. They make it 8% because they don't want all the localities, the provinces and so forth, to strive to get over 8%. If they strive to get over 8%, that's what the central government wants. They'd like about 9 or 9.5, and this was actually a target that the World Bank began to propose in the mid-1990s when it was clear that 7% was too low. But let's just assume, nevertheless, that that's as a conservative sort of settling position they go here. What happens to the year-on-year? As you can see, even it was 10.7% last quarter, it gets up to 11.6% with my quarter-on-quarter. And so that could be worrisome. The government could say, oh, my goodness, we're overheated. We've got to slow it down. And I think that would be a mistake because, as you see, if they slow down even further below the 8%, they'll eventually discover, as they always have, that the year-on-year number lags what's really going on. It informs policymakers too late. If we want to see what the PBOC number does, you can see it. This is the PBOC's year-on-year. Oh, come on. I'm sorry, my fingers are a little fat. If it's still 8%, they get up to almost 13%. So somewhere we're going to see a between 12 and 13% sort of outcome for first quarter growth at a minimum. And you could that might scare a number of people and policymakers. But one of the things that Wanjia Bao said at the NPC was we're aware of measuring things based on a year earlier when it was output was very low. And so I think that the reason that it's steady as she goes, we're going to keep the stimulus going, is that they're aware of this statistical issue and they're not going to look at the year-on-year data, they're not going to look at the headline data. Even though they haven't published it yet, they promised it for this year, they're looking at their own estimates of the quarter-on-quarter outlook. All right, that's a technical issue. So is it overheating? It may look like it is. I think there's a serious question about whether it is or not. Let me switch to trade. One of the most interesting things about what's happened in 2009 is that China's trade surplus has dropped dramatically. We've seen in the second half of last year, and by the way, the Treasury report coming out, and I, as China desk and then manager of the Asia office in the Treasury Department, I've prepared, helped prepare a lot of those reports. It's meant to cover the last 6 months of 2009. Well, in the last 6 months of 2009, China's trade surplus dropped 50%. So it would be very interesting if the Treasury could justify claiming that China was manipulating its currency for trade advantage when the surplus had dropped 50%. And actually, if you can see down in here, the first 2 months of this year, it's dropped 50% as well compared to last year. So that has implications also for GDP growth. And I'm glad that Tom mentioned his discussion with Peter this morning about what's happening to domestic demand, because this is actually just monthly data, and you can see that all the red numbers, that surplus has really declined quite a bit, except for early last year. If we begin looking at growth, the red numbers here is China's GDP growth that I showed you before, year on year, the standard way of showing it. This is domestic demand growth. And when you correct for prices of trade, China actually, because of the rapid rise in oil prices in 2008, China actually had, in real terms, in price-corrected terms, had a trade deficit, had a decline in its trade surplus early in 2008, and then the trade surplus actually jumped up. And so what we've seen, when that growth rate up here is 6%, 7%, 6.4%, that was a combination of a recovery in export surplus because imports really collapsed, and very weak domestic demand. And you had weak domestic demand by this calculation in both the fourth quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009. That was the challenge that the stimulus was meant to correct, and it really did so. And then only in the second quarter did the real effect of the international crisis hit China, as China's trade surplus began to really fall dramatically and its exports weakened and caught up with the weakening in imports. Many of the imports, of course, were parts and kits leading into the exports, so they were a leading indicator of the decline in exports. So the interesting question is, what if China's trade surplus stops declining? You don't get any more of this negative impact on GDP growth. You're sitting here with 15 percentage points of growth due to domestic demand last quarter. So you would hope that kind of pressure on overheating, if it's not modified by continued reduction in the trade surplus, would also come down some. So there's an interesting mix here. And many Chinese are saying, well, our trade surplus is going to continue to fall this quarter and next quarter. Well, that's fine, and that's largely because of import growth. And so if China is able to open up its imports in a way that helps qualify or meet this domestic demand, then we could see progress going forward in this year, particularly in the first half, that needn't be overheated. But it's a very interesting picture of the role of domestic demand moderated by the decline in the trade surplus. Now, I want to these are statistics that are related to that, so I won't go anymore. I just noticed that to get 15 percentage points of growth, domestic demand was actually growing at 17%. It started with a little smaller share than 100% of GDP. Inflation, this is the headline, and you can see it popped up. We had the CPI jump up to 2.5%, 2.7%. Oh, don't do that. And if you do a seasonally adjusted, you see that, in fact, it's a significant uptick in prices, in CPI prices, on a seasonally adjusted basis, too. Not as much as the hog crisis of this right here of 2007 that caused a lot of inflationary scare, not as serious as the huge snowstorms early in 2008 that caused so much trouble, but and early last year, but still something to watch. It's considered temporary because of Chinese New Year, the press say, but this is seasonally adjusted. It's corrected for Chinese New Year seasonality. So there's something to watch in terms of inflation. I'm not sure that's such a bad thing. China has a little inflation. That's an effective revaluation of its currency without changing the nominal currency position. And it has a different impact on imports. It represents strong demand that also could help rebalance the external trade surplus. So the inflation picture is still moderate, but worth watching. Now, I'm going to shift gears a little bit quickly before I get into the exchange rate. This is an estimate of where U.S. treasuries are in the world late last year, bonds and bills. And as you can see, I've pulled these data out of various treasury sources just after China sold some $40-odd billion in bills and bought some bonds. And Japan went ahead as the largest foreign holder. But here's China. More are held by the Federal Reserve System, more by banks and pension insurance companies in the United States. And as you can see, China's holdings are roughly less than 10% of all the outstanding bills. So it's hard to think that China really has a sort of a stranglehold on the market for bonds. But nevertheless, we hear about China's very large reserves. I would caution us to remember that China's reserves aren't that large compared to its money supply. And if you look at what happened to South Korea, both in the Asian financial crisis and in this crisis, it had roughly the same share of its money supply in foreign exchange reserves as China had at the beginning of the crisis. And in both cases, it tanked badly, needed bailouts first from the Fed and then from China and Japan. So there's an issue about whether these reserves are in fact so large if China decides to open up its capital account when currency could be converted very quickly into foreign currency and disappear, as it did, example, in Singapore, which had over 100% of its money supply in foreign reserves, didn't have a problem. This also brings up the Wen Jiabao's criticism of the United States. Are these reserves safe? Is the United States being responsible with its fiscal policies? And I think that's a complete useful piece of theater for domestic Chinese political purposes. But in fact, and I think Wen Jiabao and others know this very well, the best way to protect the value of the U.S. Debt that's outstanding is for the U.S. to have a larger deficit to recover its economic growth rate so that the buoyancy of taxes when an economy is growing rapidly can repay U.S. debt. If we stay and worry about the deficit at this level, as Wen Jiabao was encouraging us to do, the macroeconomist in me, the development economist in me, the student of public finance as a graduate student, one of my two specialties, says that's a big mistake. And so I think it's understandable in this world of theater that each government needs to find things to criticize the other about because they're so committed to engagement. And that engagement through the strategic dialogues puts both sides at risk domestically. And so this The danger, of course, is that the theater gets out of control. And this is my concern about the U.S., because for the United States, the theater has moved in the direction of heightened concern about the exchange rate. Here, by the way, there's part of the language of, and vociferous volume around the exchange rate is the idea that the Chinese have repegged their currency to the U.S. dollar. And I think we need to, I don't know how many of you looked at the Chinese for Wang Jiabao's press conference or listened to it. What he said was, renminbi de jiazhe bing bu di gou, bing bu di gou. It's certainly not undervalued. Okay, well, I did, you know, the tone I may not have right, but certainly not undervalued, opens up the possibility that maybe it's overvalued in his mind. Maybe the Chinese think it's overvalued because the central bank governor, Zhou Xiaochuan, said, well, this is a, this fixed relationship since the summer of 2008, that's a temporary crisis-related provision, is what he said. So everybody said, oh, that means they're going to start revaluing again. Well, if we look at what has actually happened, China here began pegging the renminbi to a basket of currencies of which the euro was a very large part. So as and they did that sort of with a lag. The euro had strengthened a lot of complaints that the Chinese were riding the dollar down vis-a-vis the euro. So they started coming up, and the euro happily rose. So you had this combination, and boom, suddenly the crisis hit. The euro tanked. Don't do that. And China, if it were following a basket, what would it have done? It should have devalued vis-a-vis the dollar. But that would have been bad for a couple of reasons. One, it would have increased the panic in the world that everything was becoming unhinged. Secondly, it would have had significant political repercussions here in Washington. So they didn't do that. And this, I think, is what Zhou Xiaochuan, the central bank governor, is referring to when it's a special case, special policy. They decided just not to follow the euro down to the degree that they would if they followed their basket. Euro looked like it was recovering, and then we've gotten the Greece problem. It's back down again. If this continues to tank, China's at a disadvantage vis-a-vis its European trading partners or finds itself. You could say, well, maybe they'll start to come down a little bit. That may be part of what the Bing Budigo may have implied. But anyway, there I'm totally guessing. But let's move on to a little more serious discussion, because there are two theories in the United States, and I'm probably the only holder of one, but actually I've heard a few other people say they agree with it. One theory is that the Chinese have manipulated their exchange rate and also used industrial policy and state bank loans to force a trade surplus and to force the United States and other trading partners to buy their products, therefore creating imbalances in the world. The other theory is that the United States created so much liquidity in the 2000s through highly leveraged debt that it bought throughout the world at a degree that nobody could really resist, and surpluses piled up. And I think that is that's the conclusion of my looking at the data. There is a special issue of the Journal of International Banking and Finance that looked at the causes of the U.S. current account deficit, and it concluded that in the first place, since surpluses showed up all over the world and the big deficit was in the United States, you had to look at the United States for the cause of these imbalances. Also, that if the Asian savings glut was the cause, how come you didn't see deficits all around the rest of the world also caused by the Asian savings glut? So the conclusion there also is that you can't just point to one region or country. And when talking to Federal Reserve economists, and I point out some of these data saying, you know, this Asian savings glut speech by Chairman Bernanke, they said, oh, well, we weren't really thinking about China when we wrote that. We were thinking about other Asian economies. But the mantra is that foreign surplus equals foreign savings. This has to hold. It's an identity in economics. The question is which causes which, and a lot of people, it's very sexy now to assume that, oh, yeah, savings, that must cause the foreign surplus. But the other possibility, of course, is that if you have a foreign surplus and countries can't absorb it very fast, their savings build up. And that seems to me to be what has happened in China's case. And so let's look at exports and GDP. Does China's GDP growth force exports? Oh, don't do that. Or does the demand for China's exports push up its GDP? That's the debate, and you need to look at some data to try to sort this out. I've already given some indication based on where surpluses and deficits appear in the world. I'm going backwards. Here is a quick picture of the U.S. current account surplus deficit. This is the savings and loans. Some of you have seen these pictures already because I've shown them in other presentations. And here's the great deficit of the 1990s and 2000. This is the rest of the world and their surpluses. This is China, very almost nothing until about 2004, 2005, and then it comes up. The SNL crisis hits right in. I mean, the subprime lending is in here. China's not yet really an actor in terms of surpluses. So it's very hard to blame China for sort of the outbreak of the financial crisis as recycling money. That doesn't work. Instead, it's much easier to say here is this outpouring of buying power, which, by the way, also showed up in the U.S. Domestic housing market, and it resulted in surpluses all over the world. China finally caught up, came late to the game, if you will. Did I write this? No, here we go. It correlates with U.S. credit growth. This is U.S. credit growth and the current account deficit, and that also works back here in the savings and loan period. Huge leveraged borrowing back in here that caused spending to spill out into the world. China, of course, bumping along very slow. And when we get to where China's surplus actually appeared, it didn't. This is a log normal, so that you get the slope of the line is the speed of growth of both exports and imports. And you see it wasn't because exports accelerated. Imports slowed. China had a SARS crisis here. It pumped up its economy in response to SARS, got overheated, slowed down. Investment growth slowed to single digits. Some people say, oh, yeah, but then they had all that steel capacity, and so they started exporting steel, and that became a problem. I've looked at that. It's not true in value terms. China actually bought more steel and accelerated its purchase in value terms. In tonnage, yes, so they made a shift in quality that fit their own currencies. But was this caused by the exchange rate? By a weakness in Chinese import growth? Very hard to argue that that's the case. Very hard to argue that. Now, this shows U.S. housing prices. This is actually surpluses by three major surplus groups in the world: Northern Europe, non-mainland China, East Asia, and oil exporters. And if you look at them, they pretty much match the U.S. deficit. There's some other deficit. There's some other deficit countries in Latin America and in other fringe parts of the world, so that these don't match perfectly. But you can see here and here, there's quite a close correlation between the spending explosion in the United States and the U.S. deficit and surpluses elsewhere, with China coming in very late in the game. So my conclusion is that the exchange rate explanation, it's a good story. The problem is it's sort of a high school economics story where you've just taught that price can affect demand and supply. You haven't yet talked about many other less sort of nifty relationships that can completely swamp price effects and exchange rate effects. And so I think the data are pretty clear that the demand explosion in the United States due to deregulation, this isn't because of budget deficits in the United States or Federal Reserve policy. It's because of money created by the financial system, because it was allowed to do so when new instruments weren't regulated. That pushed on a lot of the world funds that built up faster than they could spend them. China spent them pretty fast until it had to control inflation after SARS. And it's a shame to me that, and it's understandable that we need some theater this year because it's an election year, but we need to be very careful not to let the theater damage U.S. national interests and particularly our long-range security interests, because it could influence how we respond as an economy, how we reshape our educational system, how we reshape the fluidity of our labor force through health care reform and pension reform, a whole range of very difficult issues. We could say, no, China's a cheater, therefore we don't have to worry very much. And by the way, those China's are cheaters, so we really need to be nasty with them. Those are the two serious concerns that I have coming out of the NPC and the U.S. reaction to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bert. That's a very, very interesting and challenging proposition of alternative explanations and facts in a different light than what we've seen in Paul Krugman's very strong editorial comment this week and his blog, especially following up on that. And I spent the last 10 days, a good portion of my time up on Capitol Hill, and had heard from many senators and congressmen on this subject views that are orthogonal to what you've had to say today, a very different take on the facts, and I certainly hope people will have the benefit of hearing your analysis as we go forward in the congressional debate over the next month and a half. Just a little adjustment, we'll be ready to go on to the. I should remind people, if you haven't turned off your telephones, please turn them off. It'll become especially important when we bring the microphones out for the Q&A that they interact with the Bluetooth system. It's important to turn them off.
Thank you, Bert, for this technical assistance. You're more adept than I am at finding my slides. I will comment slightly more broader on the China economic situation, comment on the stimulus program, on what it tried to achieve, what it has achieved, on the threat of domestic inflation and property bubbles, and also on the much-talked-about problem or alleged problem of local government debt. A stimulus program, as you all know by now, has been huge in China, perhaps even in absolute term, the largest in the world, been very effective in helping China to climb out of the hole very quickly through domestic demand. China, I think, as Bert emphasized, is not an export-driven economy, as most people say. Net exports have accounted for only about one percentage point over the last 10 years of China's 9.5% growth. Output, employment, and confidence indicators have all continuously improved since the crisis bottomed out around March last year. But, of course, as you also know, problems have arisen. There is now much higher inflation, as Bert also referred to. There's much anxiety about property bubbles. According to a public opinion poll in China just last week, housing affordability is now rated to be the top public problem. And, of course, we know about the trade tensions. As of December last year, the government began very cautiously to embark on an exit strategy from this stimulus-driven program by tightening a little bit, just a little bit, on the monetary side. On balance, my feeling is that unless the Chinese make big policy mistakes and unless we have a serious second dip in the United States or Europe, prospects for China in the near-term future look pretty good, sustained high growth. The objective of the stimulus program, quickly revive employment and stimulate domestic demand through massive consumer loans. They have expanded enormously the credit availability for mortgages and for consumer durables, automobiles and things like that, and, of course, infrastructure. I think infrastructure probably accounted for roughly 50% of the China stimulus program. And the hope was that by reviving the property sector, particularly domestic residential real estate, they could also revive the economy, because that's a sector on which the government has a lot of leverage and influence, and that's exactly what happened. The second major objective was more longer term, but set in motion immediately to reduce China's dependence on consumer markets in the West. China has now realized how vulnerable they are to contractions in demand in the United States and Europe, and they want to avoid that vulnerability in the future by promoting very strongly South-South trade, the ASEAN Plus One Free Trade Association, FTA, came into being on the 1st of January this year. It's the world's largest FTA, larger than, larger than NAFTA. And another factor that has not been mentioned is it was clearly China's objective to use the opportunity to tighten as quickly and as much as possible economic and financial relations with Hong Kong and with Taiwan. Taiwan mainland trade is now three times more important in dollar terms than Taiwan-U.S. trade. It used to be the other way around 10 years ago. And, of course, the promotion of the RMB as an international currency is quietly also being used by the Chinese. This is essentially a slide that Bert also showed. The blue line is China's way of presenting the national statistics, which is always year on year. The red line is the way we would do it in the U.S., that is quarter on quarter, seasonally adjusted, annualized. The only difference here is I have it slightly going up here. In the last quarter of 2009, Bert had it going down. What explains the success of the stimulus program? Well, I think it was very well designed and very timely. It put in place only 6 weeks after the collapse of Lehman's on the 5th of November last year. Collapse of Lehman's was the middle of September last year. I think China was perhaps the first large economy to come with an articulated stimulus program of that, certainly of that size. Why it worked so well is, I think, mainly because all the additional demand that China pumped into the economy translated very quickly, all the additional liquidity translated very quickly into incremental aggregate demand, which did not happen in the U.S. All the stimulus money in the U.S. compensated at best for the deleveraging in the private sector. China didn't have that problem, so they could stimulate aggregate demand much more quickly than the U.S. Furthermore, we should not forget that China had stimulus programs in the late 80s under Zhu Rongji in response to the Asian financial crisis. They did it then, they do it again now. All these local governments remember how to do these things quickly. China was then also the first to respond to a crisis with a stimulus program. And these local governments know how to put together projects very quickly. The fiscal situation was very strong, and as Tom Byrne also emphasized, the banking system was actually quite strong after 10 years of very intensive reforms and very liquid. So they could respond to the government's dictum or the government's to lend more liberally. And they didn't need to borrow from the central bank for that because they were so very liquid themselves. Now, some people have complained that this stimulus program-driven growth is not sustainable, and I completely agree with that, but that's in the nature of stimulus programs. We shouldn't complain about that. Here's some illustration of unsustainability, both money, M2, and credit expansion in 2009, over 30%. Investment accounted for 92% of total growth last year, which is, of course, unsustainable. But let's look at this one here. Domestic demand at 12.3%, as Tom Byrne correctly quoted me as having said, this is the 8.3% growth plus the minus 3.6% net contribution of net exports. Incredible.
60% of the second half of the year.
Yeah, but the 12.3% positive in China compares to a minus 2.6% in the United States. So the non-sustainability is not a point. This is in the nature of stimulus programs. Here you see what happened to the credit expansion. The program was originally presented as a fiscal stimulus program. In reality, it was much more a monetary stimulus program. Here's the monthly expansion of new credit. The red line is the same, but on a 3 months average moving forward basis. January was a big problem. I don't think the government anticipated that, but in the first 2 weeks of January, they had something like 1.4 trillion RMB credit expansion again. The government pulled its hair out in despair and began to climb down in the second half of January and in February. But this is at the heart of what has happened, this the credit expansion. And all that could be done without a single penny being lent by the central bank to the banks, all based on their own liquidity. Now, some people have expressed concern that China is getting over-leveraged, and I think if current trends continue, that is indeed a concern. But if you look at the current situation, China is not really badly over-leveraged. In fact, the government part, which is the blue part at the bottom, which is here 38%. Tom Burns suggested somewhere between 40 and 50%, and I have no problem with that. But that still wouldn't raise the total very much. Japan is much more highly leveraged. Singapore, Taiwan, and Hong Kong are all more highly leveraged than China. So I'm not overly concerned, provided the exit from the stimulus program is successfully managed. But there are serious risks. Much higher inflation in February than in January. I think that's partly the effect of the Chinese New Year, partly the cold winter, which has driven off a lot of food prices in China. But it may also be due partly to overstimulation of domestic consumption. The Chinese government has financed subsidies for consumption so much that I'm a little worried that they're overdoing it, and yet the rest of the world is complaining that China is not consuming enough. I'm worried about the opposite. Producer price inflation is up. That will squeeze margins of the manufacturing sector in particular. But if exports do well in the rest of this year, I think that will not be a problem that will constrain manufacturing sector expansion. The most serious factor I'm worried about is wages. Contrary to what I and many others had expected, the labor market tightened up much more quickly. I had expected that migrant unemployment would be a persistent problem, but that has not happened. A, because the economy expanded much more quickly than we had expected, and B, many of the migrants decided not to return to the East Coast, partly because the government is creating so many jobs in the interior and living conditions generally are improving. Another risk, of course, is NPL growth, but I agree with Tom's comment that that's not likely to upset the apple cart, even if NPL start growing again for a little bit. A very serious risk is international protectionism. We all know about it. It doesn't require comment. Sino-US tensions are at a high point. I'm very worried about that. I don't know where that's going. What we also have heard a lot about in recent weeks, which was the subject of a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal this morning, is that at least the U.S. part of the foreign business community is getting a little sour on China. I'm not an expert on that subject. I'm potentially very worried. I don't know how extensive those feelings are in the broader international investment community. The problem of bubble formation is in the property sector, not in the share prices, as it was, say, in the late 90s and in 2007. We then, if you see this, clearly had bubble effects. Today, we don't have bubble effects in the share market in China. We have bubble effects in the property sector, which is, I think, in some ways, a hopeful sign that it is not widespread. As I mentioned, there is a lot of concern that's been expressed in recent weeks in the press and elsewhere about the effect that we don't have a handle on the local government debt in China. That's not recorded as debt because local governments, by Chinese law, are supposed to have balanced budgets, yet they all borrow through legally formed, locally owned companies. Victor Shea, a professor at Northwestern University, just recently did an exhaustive study. He calculated that the de facto local government debt, this is not de jure because it's really owed by their companies, that ultimately the local governments will be responsible. Estimated maybe as high as 30% of GDP. That's the highest estimate I have seen. If it is 30% and central government debt, registered official debt, is about 17 or 18%. We have about 47, 48% total government debt in China, which is still amongst the lowest in the world. Why I am not so really concerned about this local government debt is all these loans are backed by real assets, so they're all collateralized, usually by land, local government owned. And most of these projects, like subways, like light rail systems, are actually revenue-earning, like tollways. And all the assets and the liabilities of the public sector companies, of which there are many hundreds, are always in the public sector. So who's going to pull the plug on that system? It's very unlikely that, even though the debt may be much higher than we realized previously, that this is going to trip the Chinese economy. Urban property prices, I'm more concerned about. Again, we don't really have a very good comprehensive picture, but it is fairly obvious from the anecdotal evidence that there are huge bubbles developing at the high end of the residential market in the major cities. Whether these bubbles will actually pop at some point is uncertain. The demand continues very high, but we have all heard the reports about $3 to $40 million apartments in Shanghai on the Huangpu River. One reason why I'm slightly less concerned than others is that commercial property prices, which will also run away, price increases until very recently, appear to have turned down in the last 6 months and not causing any problems. No bankruptcies, nothing. So this is a very hopeful sign that property prices have been able to actually level off and begin a little bit down without causing a serious problem. Finally, why we don't really know what the situation is, the NBS, the National Bureau of Statistics, publishes a major housing price index for 70 cities in China. That's what everybody looks at to measure what housing prices really do in the broader Chinese urban housing market. That shows fairly rapid price increases, but for 2009 as a whole, it showed only 1.5% increase over 2008. Mr. Ma, the head of the MBS, was questioned by NPC delegates in Beijing last week, and they all challenged him because this public opinion poll had just become available, in which 60% of the respondents had said that the declining affordability of houses was their single most public important single serious concern. In response to that, MPC questioning, Mr. Ma admitted that there might be a problem with these statistics. So these broader housing index may not be reliable. And the problem of a bubble forming in the broader housing market in China, not just the high end of the market, is something we have to be concerned about. But we just don't know that. Now, on trade, Bert has already given you the story. In 2009, exports fell much more sharply than imports, so China's trade balance contracted. And it is indeed slightly ironic that in a situation where the trade balance contracted by trade surplus contracted by 35%, that people suddenly begin to complain about the RMB again. And I have some other arguments in case that question comes up later on. Is China serious about rebalancing? I believe they are, but time will tell. If the trade surplus starts going up sharply again in this year, 2010, I would be worried. But so far we have seen the opposite. Even in the first 2 months of 2010, the trade surplus further declined. So whether 2010 as a whole is going to see a very runaway surplus again, as some people fear, including Paul Krugman apparently, we will then have reason to be concerned. I don't see it at the moment. China is very aware of these problems. Mr. Wen Jiabao's speech for the MPC was actually 95% about the need for structural reform in China's economy. Now, he's been saying that since 2003. But I've not seen statements as forceful and as consistent as he has made on the MPC speech last week. All the other factors you can read, they're obviously on the agenda, but it's not easy to engineer the rebalancing of a large economy. It's about as difficult to do in China as it is in the U.S. Most people complain about China's low consumption. That's quite frankly nonsensical. China is the largest and is the fastest growing large consumer market in the world, by far. By my estimates, China's private consumption last year grew a little over 9%, faster than GDP growth, which again points in the right direction. Consumer growth in China over the last 10 years, conservatively estimated 7.5%, in the U.S., 3.6%. So there is a problem, is an unbalanced economy, but it's not a slow-growing private consumption. The problem is overinvestment in manufacturing, and that would be the subject of another seminar. Government consumption, Through the budget is also rapidly increasing. Government spending on social sectors increased very sharply last year. Health plus 48%, education plus 28%. And as I already mentioned, I believe that private consumption, but that's a little hard to measure, exceeded GDP consumption last year, which would be the first time in over a decade. Finally, the first very important conclusion I come to, as a result of the global meltdown, which started in the U.S. as a result of the subprime crisis, the U.S. has lost its shine as an economic model for China. And that's very, very serious, because the U.S., even though no Chinese would admit that, was the tacit objective for many of their reform policies. This is completely gone today, and not only in China, I'm afraid. And the political implications of that are extremely serious. The crisis has certainly confirmed China's government belief that the state has to maintain a very large role in the economy, through effective ownership and control of the banking system, land, and a limited number of very large state enterprises. China is now definitely trying to wean away from its dependence on U.S. and European consumer markets. That's a long-term process. I think China's economy will rebalance, but it will take 5 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, for adding to the insights and the bright light that's been put on the facts of the situation today. One point that I find useful in discussing the policy implications of what's happened over the last year and a half is to, it was implicit in your statistics in each of the presentations, but put it more explicitly, American exports to China have grown 65% in the past year, and yet we're talking about how we have difficulty exporting to China, and we're being disadvantaged. Paul Krugman has put it in very strong terms, and he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and therefore taken quite seriously. But now comes the portion of the program where we turn to you, the audience, and look forward to your questions. Sometimes you may have a comment. We ask that both be brief, and when you raise your hand and are identified, please use the microphone and identify yourself, and then ask us a short question. But we'll start in the front here with Paula Stern.
Thank you. I am Paula Stern, and I thank you for the presentations. I have a question that's more U.S.-centric to you, Bert. When it comes to the Treasury having to make its decision whether China is a, quote, currency manipulator or not, does the Treasury take into account the trade shifts? Does it have to be tied not only to some of the calculations that Paul Krugman and others have made, that it's, you know, 25% to 40% undervalued, and or do they also have to show that there has been a shift in terms of actual trade transactions in order to do that? And that's kind of my technical question, because I do think, as you said, Doug, that we're in for a very interesting month and a half here.
Well, thank you, Paula. That's a great question. The Treasury report every 6 months actually covers every country in the world.
Yes.
And Treasury's experience, and actually I think the academic wisdom, is that there is no easy way to tell whether a currency is undervalued or not. That's why you hear a lot of discussion about flexibility, because there's a much stronger case in economics for having a flexible currency. If you have an open capital account, if you don't have a flexible currency regime, you become a slave to foreign monetary policy. So a lot of talk about flexibility, which people assume should mean revaluation, but there is no hard and fast rule. And so that's one dimension. The Treasury report is really about not just whether its currency is undervalued or not. It's whether it's manipulated for trade gain. So you have, and the Treasury has said already it is undervalued, and that decision has come. Whether they cite China as a manipulator or not, As I said, it's got a lot of factors in it. I am, how to say it politely, unconvinced by Krugman's assertions that jumps in China's reserves or its trade surplus are a sign of a currency undervaluation. As I said, that's high school economics, just to think that price governs everything. People across the street actually have a model where they assume that price is the – it's a mathematical – assume that price is the only factor. Then they do 50 countries and show, lo and behold, that in order to get current accounts to correct themselves, you need huge revaluations. They also assume something that's really should be controversial. Should rich countries run surpluses or deficits? The sort of microeconomic thinking is, well, gee, they have low return on capital because they're already rich. They should run surpluses, and the developing countries should run deficits. That looks very bad from a developing country point of view. But that's the assumption, again, that other, vocal proponents of this view take. So the Treasury Department probably will make a call, depending on what kind of call they get from the White House. And so it's a highly political year. I, with all my experience there and outside, I have to say personally, I would find it quite surprising if they cited China as a manipulator. They'll probably cite again that it's undervalued. Will Congress make a law that says, well, if it's undervalued, then will they change the ADA omnibus trade bill to just have it be undervaluation as opposed to manipulation? I don't know. But in this kind of a political year, Obama came in very China-friendly. He may have to shift back to the middle the way earlier presidents have had to shift in the other direction toward the middle, because to keep the engagement going in such in so many wonderful dimensions, people have to stay in power.
On this point, we could spend a whole seminar on that, of course. I think most economists would agree that the Chinese currency remains undervalued, but there are almost no currencies in the world that are properly aligned. That's the exception, quite frankly. The U.S. dollar is overvalued, even by Paul Krugman's standard. But why I have difficulty with the manipulation is the following. China's trade surplus really ran away in about 2004. What was that due to? Something China did? No, China did nothing. It was the explosive growth of liquidity in the United States due to deregulation and so on. And that, more than any factor, drove up China's surplus. It was nothing China did. And, of course, there was very strong productivity growth in China. I think they were a little slow in realizing what was going on. They should have unpegged earlier in 2004, but they did it in the middle of 2005, and then began this gradual appreciation, which amounted to 21%. By the time, that was July 2008, what happened then? The international export trade was shrinking already, long before the crisis hit. China saw their export orders falling precipitously, even though export shipments were still rising. It was in response to precipitously falling export orders that they repegged unofficially without telling anybody, right? And now we know from Zhou Jiachuan's statement last week that this was a temporary emergency measure. From that their point of view, it's easy to understand. Now, why not call them manipulators? I have one specific reason. Don't forget that after the Lehman collapse, which was the middle of September 2008, the dollar suddenly began to appreciate, safe haven effect, right? China was then repegged. If China had been a manipulator, it would have depreciated against the dollar. It didn't do so. It ride up with the U.S. dollar for three long months, risking that it would lose export markets, but it didn't do so. Other countries benefited from that. So the whole manipulation accusation, it makes no sense, in my opinion.
Joe Bosco, I just retired from the Defense Department. I wonder if we could hear some discussion of the role of military spending in all of this, both in terms of the percentage of the budget that is devoted to the military and also how military spending is affected by the ups and downs in the international situation.
And while you think about who's going to respond to that, I'll just note that we're anticipating in the next month or so the Defense Department's report on Chinese military power. These studies have in the past been additional irritations in the political relationship between the United States and China, which have been cascading since the Taiwan arms sale announcement in January, the President's meeting with the Dalai Lama in February, and with the upcoming Treasury report and nuclear posture review and other items that are part of the annual ritual of U.S.-China relations.
Well, I'll say something first about that. I don't know if they have any of my stuff outside anymore, but there's a policy brief from about a year and a half ago, middle of 2008, in which I outlined Chinese, I guess it's the technical companion to it, outlined U.S. and Chinese defense spending and projected them going forward, but also took a shot at this unclassified Pentagon report on Chinese economic power, and that's the military power. Sorry, thanks. Because for an economist, your productive power, if you want to produce a product and a military force produces a certain amount of defense capability, you don't talk about your annual budget. You talk about your capital stock and your base for producing that power. The Pentagon report has only compared budgets. And in fact, it won't, and they've told me in meetings they are not ever going to compare the Chinese budget even to the U.S. budget because it's so small. And if you then, as I did in that paper, accumulate based on assumptions about the investment in hardware and depreciation and obsolescence rates, the U.S. hardware, and don't even include basing rights all over the world, you have a much bigger multiple of U.S. to Chinese military power. So the Chinese, in fact, the reported budget growth slowed dramatically, the one they've just announced. It's not clear at all whether the official budget really gives the whole story because of the role of large state-owned enterprises in that. And I think, therefore, the spending on Chinese military as a share of GDP, as a share of its budget, is in line with shares in the United States over time and in some other countries. If you look at the hardware accumulation, China is really at a disadvantage. And if you add in basing rights all over the world, China is just not a global player at all. Space-based platforms are a whole other area, and that's very hard to know where that is, but the Chinese have a very active space program. So if you project the Chinese economy ahead, as I did in that paper, into this century, and assume just the sort of minimal standard shares of GDP going into the budget and shares of the budget going into the military and rates of accumulation and depreciation and obsolescence, by about 2060 or 2070, you get a hardware accumulation of China that matches or surpasses that of the United States, given relative growth rates. Now, that assumes that everybody keeps growing along those paths. So it's coming, but, boy, it sure isn't right around the corner.
I don't believe your paper version of your policy brief is outside, but it can be obtained on CarnegieEndowment.org. Moreover, there's a very nice comparable study done by the U.S.-China Policy Institute on U.S. defense spending and Chinese defense spending, which I'm sure is available on their website as well. John, did you have a question?
Thank you. John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. This is a very timely event, and I thank all the panelists for your views. But it sounds like this is not in the heart of Washington. It sounds like this is in Beijing. I just want to make sure that you guys are not bankrolled by China. I still want to ask about the Treasury report. Is it going to be a political report? I know the political situation this year, but is it going to be a political report or a financial report? How much influence will the current the report, and how likely that China will thank you.
First, let me comment about the heart of Washington. I like to think I and we are the heart of Washington. After all, it's deep in the bosom of the city, and the surface facial expressions don't really show what the heart feels. In this town, there are a lot of very loud special interests and lobbyists looking for any way to gain from government. And if you have China that you can somehow point to, you will be very vocal. But there are large numbers of very influential interests who, both strategic and economic and commercial and financial, who aren't going to get out there and hug the panda as it gets on, you know, the airplane heading out, but who will be very quietly persuasive that the situation is much more complex. And so in that regard, I like to think we are the heart of Washington, just it beats quietly. The Treasury report being political or not, the Treasury has a strong, long tradition of being non-political and really relying on its experts. It's only in the last administration that you saw the Secretary actually on the campaign trail. That's sort of not done. It has a very fine group of professional civil servants that actually populate most of its Deputy Assistant Secretary positions. Those are not largely open to political appointment. Nevertheless, when there is such strong pressure, I mean, the pressure when I was at Treasury, really, I would say, heavily from Wall Street to the White House was very apparent. And yet it had the effect of lots of activity in Treasury on behalf of financial institutions around the world, but not necessarily on something like the exchange rate call. I think that changed a bit in the second Bush administration, because the pressure became so great. And I personally also saw it come out in the new IMF regime that appeared in that time period. So I think it has gotten more political. I think Secretary of the Treasury Geithner made a slip when he was in his hearings in his written statements that was quickly pulled back. It's a question to me. I would like to think the Treasury will stay apolitical, and given the evidence, the sort of continuing collapse in China's trade surplus and those other issues, whether that will be trumped by the need to show toughness. I'm hoping that the visit of the Dalai Lama, the arms sales to Taiwan, the Google uproar, that the some human rights issues can let us show our legitimate toughness for issues that we feel very strongly about to such a degree that we won't have to also show it through the exchange rate report.
John, I'd like to just offer a thought. As to the current mood, I think that a lot of the journalists at the major mainstream papers and magazines in the U.S. have sort of had a mood swing and have been writing everything up as negative when, if you look closely at what the policy implications are in the behavior of the Chinese counterparts, the behavior doesn't bear out the characterizations in the media, but it's fanning this heated atmosphere here. Now, so that's a reality I guess Treasury and others will have to deal with. They also have to deal with the fact that on May 24th and 25th, about half our cabinet's going to go to China and meet with counterparts. And if we launch the Secretary of Treasury off with a scathing report which runs against public opinion in China, one can imagine that the strategic and economic dialogue in China in May may not be a very productive one from the American point of view. So I think they're going to have to look at both of the audiences as they prepare this report, not just what's being said in Washington. And the yellow shirt?
Thanks. Pete Kasperowitz from Sidley Austin. First, a great panel. It's great to hear numbers and people understand numbers. So I have a question about, is there, stripping away everything else, if it's possible, is it possible to determine what the effect of the roughly 20% revaluation of the renminbi was on things like trade from 2005 to 2008? I realize it's hard to strip away all the other realities, but did you guys come down anywhere in terms of, did it matter, did it not matter? Did it change anything?
I think what actually happened underlines why nominal exchange rate don't always do what people expect them to do. And by nominal exchange rate are not as important for influencing trade flows as many other factors. Trade flows are influenced by many factors. Domestic macro policies, fiscal, monetary, can have as powerful effects on trade flows as the nominal exchange rate. And the questioner allows me to illustrate that. What happened to China's trade surplus when it began to appreciate its currency? You would expect the trade surplus to come down. The opposite happened. What happened to the U.S. deficit when the dollar began to depreciate after 2002? Exactly the opposite of what you would expect on the basis of price theory. The U.S. deficit went up. I think this, more than anything, I think explains why the focus on this Chinese nominal exchange rate is misdirected energy. It's not a central issue. There are other issues much more important than that. Thank you.
It's an exercise in counter-historical analysis of what would have happened, because maybe you could say, well, then the Chinese deficit would have been much higher without that. But we keep focusing on the exchange rate with the dollar. The Chinese make the same mistake. In fact, their trade with Europe now is bigger than with the United States. And they also have significant trade with Japan and now with many other countries. So it's the trade-weighted version. And as I pointed out, one of the reasons that it appreciated vis-a-vis the dollar is because the euro was appreciating even faster, so China was still devaluing vis-a-vis the euro. So you'd have to ask what was happening to trade with all of China's trade partners and not just focus on the dollar renminbi exchange rate.
Michael Martin from CRS, Peter and Albert, and also Tom. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to affect you as much. I was a little bit surprised by your recommendation or your concern about wages, or I assume real wages, not nominal wages, inside China. There is an argument that in order to restructure their economy, they're going to have to refocus more of their output towards wages in order to boost consumption. And similarly, within the United States, there may be a need for real wages to increase so people can afford their accumulated debt. So I was wondering if you could talk both in China and the United States on the apparent low level of wages over a period of time. There's been the argument that in China, real wages haven't gained as much as the economy should have.
Well, that's a great question. Of course, wages, if you just look at the manufacturing sector and don't talk about household incomes, are only part of the picture. And in fact, household incomes, both in urban and rural areas, in real terms, have grown dramatically. Now, whether that's reflected in the income of migrant workers, almost 2 years ago, we discovered that the Chinese had implemented in late 2007 throughout 2008 a program to close small polluting plants in South China. And that laid off a lot of workers. The governor complained. And so very hard to know whether that was from the crisis. Certainly not. It predated the crisis. But it's had downward pressure on some wages. Although, you know, there's the issue for China is whether the wages are actually growing and the pressure as productivity is growing. And labor productivity is growing quite rapidly, particularly in the period of high demand, so that the wage increase supports this. It's part of the household income picture that's so positive. And I would really say that the structural change we're seeing in China is supporting higher wages by making workers more productive. And that's the best sort of solution you can get, particularly if you're looking for incentives. The Chinese have created a whole range of incentives. If you get an education, if you take a risk, if you move to some place where there's better work, you're going to make more income. And so as families raise their incomes in this way, the whole country benefits. I can't be as optimistic about the United States. We have had a deteriorating income distribution for many decades. I have written that I think that this, in fact, contributed to the crisis because it, in fact, left more households literally unable to afford a house and therefore vulnerable to trick them to sort of get people to think they could afford a house. And so these are important issues that aren't handled well by a free market global economy kind of theoretical underpinning. The Japanese have a very high cost of living in domestic services. The United States has really not raised its minimum wage very much compared to inflation. We have, of course, the benefit, if you want to call it that, of a continual flow of migrant workers that do a lot of our low-wage work that might go to other Americans to provide them with a decent income. And yet that's an important part of who we are, is to be welcoming immigrants. But I think the problem in the United States is we don't really know what to do about the deterioration of the income distribution, particularly when the taxing authorities, those also who want to get rid of inheritance taxes or keep them out of the way or make them permanently impossible, those that have ratcheted down the higher income level tax rates or on corporate taxes, I think Hyman Minsky, this now deceased economist, has pointed out that if you just rely on household consumption, you're going to have an unstable economy. You need to balance government consumption with household consumption, which means more taxation. We don't have, in my view, a really practical, workable, long-term vision of how an economy should function. And so I'm not as disturbed that China isn't following the U.S. economic model as much as it might have in the 1980s when the lessons were easy, which was liberalize, let prices have a role, and so forth. I think it's a difficult situation in the U.S.
If I may, just a very quick supplementary comment, not on the U.S., but on China. Real wages have been actually rising, as Bert said, quite rapidly, but less rapidly than they would have if there had not been an overall labor surplus, which kept the growth of real wages below GDP growth. China's so-called underconsumption problem, which is a purely a relative problem and not an absolute problem, is due to the fact that, household disposable incomes have grown much more slowly than GDP. And I think that indirectly has led to the underconsumption problem. Now, that's partly due, I think, to faulty, in my opinion, faulty monetary policies. China is keeping the cost of money too low, which stimulates overinvestment. I also believe that it would have been in China's interest to appreciate faster. I would admit that. But that's more a Chinese interest, in my opinion, than a U.S. interest. Finally, the interesting thing is that if we look at the results for 2009 so far, we see something quite unexpected. We see that, contrary to what I and others had expected, this 20 million unemployed migrant workers that had been laid off at the end of the second half of 2008 seem to have been fully reabsorbed, or fewer people have returned after Chinese New Year to look for jobs, because there is now a tightening labor market all over the East Coast and minimum wages are rising. Several municipalities have actually administratively raised their minimum wages in China. And so If you want to be optimistic, and I don't know whether that's fully justified, this could be the beginning of a turnaround in the rate or the ratio between household disposable incomes and GDP growth. We may have seen a turning point in 2009.
I want to thank both of you for not mentioning the Gini coefficient and blinding us with that sort of theoretical stuff. I see a hand in the back.
Yes, hello. My name is Rick Lopez. I work with the LaRouche Political Action Committee. I wanted to bring in some politics into this discussion once again. It seems to me that the transatlantic sphere is pretty much falling apart. And I know we talk about a Greek crisis, but realistically, I think it's a crisis of the entire Eurozone, especially if you look at the fact that Spain, I mean, their deficit is much larger than Greece, and they're sitting on a housing bubble that's ready to blow. Let's also not forget the collapse in Dubai, which I think was a much bigger blow than the subprime mortgage crisis in the U.S. But it seems to me that, you know, in Asia, you know, you have China and Russia and India sort of getting together and discussing agreements that potentially will lead to, you know, some pretty awesome developments. I know Putin visited China last October, and he worked out some agreements on development, on certain development of rail and nuclear power. Do you guys think that it would be a good idea for the United States to sort of, I don't know, dump the transatlantic sphere and orient a little bit more towards Asia in a positive way and stop doing stupid things like visiting the Dalai Lama and selling weapons to Taiwan? Thank you.
I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. As you know, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council of the United States, we have a very strong Asia program because Asia is so important in Europe. And so we need to really be working very closely with our cross-Atlantic partners and friends to figure out where the world economy is going. Europe is less cohesive or less coherent because it's not a single national entity by any means, particularly in its fiscal dimensions as we're learning. So I would say, no, we don't want to dump them and shift to Asia. We want to really become more global. And so that means engaging particularly in a productive way in the global financial regulatory talks ongoing now and provide some more muscle to the Financial Stability Board so that it's not just a question of coordinating financial regulation in the different spheres, two major financial spheres of the world, but actually providing some international muscle. This is anathema to many interests in the United States, but if we're going to avoid a downward spiral in the future, again, where special interests in both countries get their governments to help them be more competitive, if we're going to avoid that, we're going to need some transnational regulations, and they may not be coming very quickly, but they'll come with Europe before they'll come with anybody else.
King Canute tried to push back the tides and didn't do very well at it. The tide of globalization is one that we can't resist, and by thinking we can fragment the world into the parts we want to deal with and the parts we don't want to deal with, I think is going to mislead us. Next question, please. In the back with the tie. Yeah.
My name is Jing Zhang with Voice of America. I want to hear a little bit more about the international aspect of these U.S.-China dispute over currency. I'm particularly interested in Mr. Tom Burns, since you work in Singapore. If you can share with us your observation where the industries and the policymakers in Asia, Southeast Asia, stand on this issue. Are they hopeful that U.S. pressure might force expedited revaluation of the yuan, thus improving their competitiveness, or they're more afraid of uncertainty that this might introduce to the international trade system?
Well, the view from most of Asia is benign towards China. Part of the reason for their rapid recovery from the global crisis in Asia has been the ability of Asian countries to export to China. So they don't see the exchange rate as forming an obstacle towards increased trade with China. We see this in the East Asian countries. We see this in Japan and Korea, the smaller countries in East Asia, and, of course, Australia. I mean, last year, Korea did not go into recession. They had eked out a small GDP growth of 0.2%. Now, a lot of that was due to domestic demand, but some of it was due to the recovery in trade of the second half of the year. Recovery in exports. The same thing in Japan, although Japan did have a very sharp contraction, it's benefiting from export growth to China. And, of course, Australia. Australia grew by 2% in 2009. And demand for the commodities that Australia produces, demand in China, is very big. So China is not viewed as a threat towards East Asia. China is viewed as an opportunity and a source of prosperity.
I'm Justin Chen. I'm Taiwan Diplomacy Fellow in CNEP Brookings. My question is to Mr. Douglas. Assumably, that China's economic continue along a strategy. trajectory, sorry, and then China may be able to commit further resources to more challenging aspect. And it can also be said that the PRA's war fighting potential has grown in tandem with China's economic. And now China is trying to secure raw materials and the political influence around the global too. And it does change the balance in Taiwan's Straits. And my question is, in your opinions, does the U.S. government react to this new challenge enough and correctly? And what should the United States do more to deal in this problem? Thank you.
If I understand the question correctly, you're asking if the change in the relationship of power between Taiwan and China has been appropriately addressed by the United States government. There are always shortcomings in the way we behave in these policy areas. We, on the Taiwan issue, are governed by three communiques and law, the Taiwan Relations Act, and they don't all fit together smoothly. There are a lot of judgment calls, and we've gone from a trajectory of some 8 years of increasing tensions leading up to early 2008 between Taiwan and China, with the U.S. trying to keep them apart from each other militarily, to a period when Taiwan has reversed the trajectory toward a significant reduction of tensions, and that has been responded to with some Chinese adjustments in their policies, at least for the short term. This leaves the U.S. Sort of trying to catch up with the two sides as they've adjusted their own relationship, and puts hard issues on the president's desk. One of them was about whether to provide arms to Taiwan this year, and then the president made that decision to go ahead with a package of arms, which I think on the whole is quite a defensible package of things, which helped to keep Taiwan free, not free, but less likely to be coerced into outcomes the people of Taiwan would not support. So I think on the whole the policy is working, but how we go forward, if the trajectory of improving relations between Taiwan and China continues, is going to raise some very important challenges and cause us to examine the foundational documents, these three communiques and the Taiwan Relations Act, down the road. But I think we've got quite a few years before that's actually going to happen, and there are a lot of good things we can do to promote continued reduction of tensions between Taiwan and China in the short term. Thanks. Yes, please.
Anybody want to take that?
Question was, what's the size of the state sector, China? How has it grown? And what are the likely exit scenarios for China out of the stimulus program? The size of the state sector depends on how you define it. It's quite large. Particularly for major heavy industrial and large manufacturing establishments. It shrank dramatically 10 years ago when most small and medium-sized state-owned enterprises were sold. And what were kept were maybe the large strategic sectors that China considered important to nurture because they the foundation of its growth, they feel. Now, whether it has grown or shrunk since the crisis, which is your second part of the question, there is some analysis I've seen that says that because of merger and acquisition policies that were part of the crisis response and because of the liquidity going from banks to state enterprises that enabled them to purchase private firms, that we've seen a consolidation in state-owned or state-controlled. You have to be careful. That's why the definition is tricky, because state-controlled is in companies that are share stock share companies, where the shares are held by other state entities or partly held by other state entities, so that it's not the old state-owned enterprises where you were under a ministry and managed by the board in your local municipality, or if the biggest ones managed directly by the Planning Commission. I think that picture of M&A and of a newly empowered or spreading state sector least exaggerated. It may just not be true at all. When I followed the experience of private sector firms in the crisis, they continued to grow in terms of manufacturing output at double digits, whereas all the state sector firms grew in very low single digits, and some of them actually shrank. The stimulus and the growth of the economy clearly has a large impact on the private sector or on the quasi-private sector. I don't think we have the proper definitions of ownership or control to say the state sector is bigger, smaller. The trend is, I think, over the last 10 years, and I will continue to be after this crisis, one of the state control letting go and managing firms based on profitability. And it becomes almost less important whether they're owned or controlled by what mix of entities as to the incentive structures for management and the policies they're allowed to follow to make money. And that clearly is in the direction of more profit-oriented reward systems and risk-taking reward systems. So I think what we're going to see is as demand recovers domestically and has recovered, and as Hyman Minsky would have said, we need a continued strong role for government consumption to make a society stable and also provide the right mix of goods and services for its people, that China's transition out of this shock stimulus will be prudent and adjust to circumstances. That's one of the strengths of China's management committee system of government.
Thank you, Bert. Thank you all. We've come to the end of our time this morning. Appreciate your visiting Carnegie and sitting and listening and asking good questions. I want to thank our panel, Tom and Bert and Peter, and ask you to join me in expressing our appreciation.